Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Howell, I host the Box Set Pod with my friend Jamie and lots of other people who join us regularly, and I've been wanting to do a spin-off Box Set Pod for a while now, and I finally got round to it. It's going to be long, dull to some, fascinating to others, mildly interesting to everyone else perhaps. This isn't the regular Box Set Pod, it's something else, so if you're not happy with the long, intricate conversation that I have about creativity with my guest, then stop and listen to the next episode, which will be back to business as normal, talking about new TV shows. I've been a creative person all my life, with varying degrees of success. I've been a theatre director of big productions at a young age, a radio manager, a presenter for about 10 years, managing director of a couple of production companies and radio stations. And I came from the angle of musician, director, and then presenter, and have experienced both management as a manager and management as someone who is managed. And I think I've got a perspective that's fairly unique in that regard. And it's interested me beyond belief. Think of your favourite, it sounds boring. Think of your favourite movie star, or your favourite musician, or your favourite creative person. They are great, and they've been managed to be great within a business. Some people thrive at that and manage to navigate a course. That course is fascinating to me. Think of someone like Tom Cruise. How completely fascinating the truth of how that guy has managed his career must be, but we'll probably never know the truth about that. And what about everybody else if you're not Tom Cruise? If you've got kids who want to be actors or dancers or singers, do something creative, what can they expect? Creative people try to get paid for what they do. And when they get paid, often the person who has good business skills employs them for their creativity. The world of business has a long, long history with lots of examples of how well this relationship can go and how badly it can go as well. Even giant companies like Disney can go through decades of producing films that don't really work, and then decades of producing phenomenally creative stuff. And it's fascinated me for years, ever since I started directing plays in my garage and trying to charge a ticket price, the relationship between management and creativity, creative management, and also artists and the idea of selling your art. All that entire thing is such an interesting thing to navigate, I think. And I think now more than ever, it's important to look at these things, perhaps help those people who are normal, nice, creative human beings understand what the balance is between the old ideas of selling out, ego, protecting a vision, yet working as a team. There's so much to discuss and so many facets to it that I cannot begin to explain it all at once. And I've got more questions than answers at the moment, which is probably why I'm doing this. Perhaps I'm doing it because I've been fairly successful in my life and I want to make the world a better place, having seen some great and some awful examples of this subject. Or perhaps I'm looking for the lost holy grail of some guidebook on how to manage creativity. Hopefully, I'll find some answers that might help people who want to get into the business of show, where it's about more than just having passion. To begin with, though, it's just me, lost and confused, and starting in this forest of trying to understand how people approach it and how it works. My first guest has made some of the best TV that we've ever seen as director of photography of The West Wing. And he joined me from Los Angeles using FaceTime. And our FaceTime recorder will never be used again, because after a while, it started to record our two voices separately and out of sync, meaning that I have had to cut loads of great stuff later on due to it being awful, but some stuff has remained. It's complicated, but it wasn't consistently bad. It just did it every so often. So creative tip number one in the guidebook that I will create, use Skype rather than FaceTime if doing an interview 5,000 miles away. So please excuse the quality of the call, which again wasn't as good as Skype. But I hope you'll enjoy what we talk about and how I actually stumbled across my guest called Michael Mayers. Mike, the reason I emailed you, the reason we're talking is that I had a moment late at night. I was watching West Wing and there was just this great shot that I thought captured the size of the Oval Office. It was shot from kind of the ground. The whole composition of the picture just probably amounted to about 4 seconds worth of a shot. And I just thought, oh, that's great. I trained as a director years ago and it's not often that I'm just impressed by the detail. And I know West Wing is a very good show in general and the detail's good, but I immediately thought, that's really good. And I'm going to email the person who, or find them on Twitter. I eventually tracked you down, director of photography for that episode. Can you take credit for the shot that I'm talking about?
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, a movie set or a TV set is a huge collaboration, and that's really the fun of it. So, you know, what I will take credit for is, you know, helping that collaboration along. So, you know, in the case of that shot, it's likely that the director and the camera operator were noodling around by the camera and found that frame and decided, oh, that's good. Or yeah. it may have just been the camera operator, or it may have just been the director, or it may have been me coming over and say, boom down, let's see what that looks like lower.
It just seemed like such a... do you know the shot that I'm talking about?
Yeah, I'm pretty
about?
Sure I do, yeah.
Yeah, because it was like... It stood out because it seemed to be at a much greater distance from the other shots and much lower down, and it's quite an unusual shot. The shots, whilst excellent, seem fairly standard normally, but that one just seemed very filmic. And the characters looked like they were drowning, which is what the situation required as well.
To try to figure out how to tell the story using pictures rather than words. go ahead.
And how much is that affected by... Sorry, carry on. I was just going to say, how possible is that? I know... the few times that I've done things in collaboration, particularly if time is of the essence and money matters, there's a feeling if you suggest something.
Well, that's always a possibility. But the thing is, I keep swinging away.
It comes in your direction.
And, sometimes I hit him, and that's very satisfying. And also, when you get a group of people that's as good as that crew and that cast is in a room together, good ideas are, you know, oftentimes, like, if I have an idea, it's possible that it'll be the fastest thing. Like, I'm actually fairly fast at what I do. And so a lot of times I can walk over and say, hey, how about this? And everybody will go, oh, yeah, great idea. Let's do that. Because they can see that not only is it good storytelling, but it's quick.
There seemed to be something about that series as well that people say this a lot. Like, I'm wary of being another person that just pours sunshine towards West Wing's ass. But the West Wing really does seem to me, I mean, I've watched it probably 4 times round now, and every time I see something new and... a lot of people seem to say, you know, this was a special thing.
Very much
even in
so.
Those later
I mean, I had been a West Wing fan.
Did it feel special
where
you were doing
to
it?
Work with them as I was living in Washington, D.C., which is a great capital of documentary work. And I had been working a lot for Discovery and National Geographic and people like that. Sure. And they came to town and they needed somebody, you know, with dramatic experience. And I had done a lot of indie films. And I had worked with John Spencer.
That's Aaron Sorkin's on the phone.
Not likely. And I'd worked with John Spencer, and somehow, you know, they said my name to John, and he said, "Oh yeah, sure, he's good." And he's a wonderful, you know, he's, you know, sadly departed, but just a fabulous actor. And a good all around good guy was.
Yeah. What was John Spencer like as a human being? What would you find him doing if you turned up on set?
One of my favorite things about John Spencer is that if you watch him, every time he walks into the Oval Office, he would button his jacket every single time. He had made a decision that, and that's the kind of actor that he was. He was a real craftsman. So, you know, like he realized that the way to say respect is every time he walks in, he would button his button. And actually
that's the commitment to stick, you know, to make that decision and then stick with it for seven series is
it's pretty impressive. Yeah. And then the thing that's so great about, you know, about that world is that then in the Camp David, episode, which is whatever that was,
he undoes the jacket.
Yeah. The button pops off. And we did a long kind of homage to the button with it falling in the mud and, you know, looking for the button and the whole kind of a whole thing. And that was the producing director at that point was Alex Graves, who's a very talented guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, look, we have to do this. And, you know, immediately all of us kind of, you know, were dumbstruck and said, oh, yes, of course, that's fabulous. And so all of a sudden we were making a music video about a button.
Were you DOP of that one?
Yes, yes, I was. Yeah.
Oh well, Mike, I'm getting on my knees to you. What work? That's amazing. What brilliant work.
At that point, Aaron was not writing at that point, so it was some other writers who were pretty good at mocking Aaron's tone, and then Alex Grave, this fabulous director, who's gone on to do some Game of Thrones, I believe, also.
Yeah, and he was in it right from the start, wasn't he?
Yes,
he directed
a
lot.
Yeah,
I read Buzz Aldrin's book. That's basically the gist is when you've been to the moon, you get pretty miserable once you get back because there's nothing else to do in life.
Did I peak already? Was that it?
Yeah.
And it's possible. But one thing that, you know, that's like what I was saying earlier about collaboration is that I have a lot of the same crew around me, even though right now the show I've been doing is a police procedural, which is, you know, somewhat straight ahead, but I have all my favorite guys with me and that makes it for a very satisfying collaboration, which is really the fun of what this job is. So
I went through an existential, or I suppose I'm going through an existential funk at the moment. Did I achieve the things that I wanted to achieve? The dream was fulfilled. And then I started writing a TV pilot with a really creative friend who I hadn't spoken to for about 10 years just because we got busy. And the same feeling happened that you're describing, and you realise that collaboration is everything. Working in an environment where you really are comfortable, the only thing that exists is trying to impress each other. You don't feel like the gun is sort of pointed at your head. It's more of a kind of I am going to impress that guy and then he's going to try and outdo me.
I mean that's really, I feel like, you know, kind of a big part of what I do is when I look for work, I'm looking for work for, like, you know, 20 of us, you know, myself and my whole camera department and all the grips and electricians. And, and, you know, they've all been with me a long time. And so, you know, whenever we can get together, we do.
Have you ever refused work because of that?
One time I was sitting in an interview for an ABC Family series. So it's a fairly soft, you know, kind of kids series. Mm. And they said, man, we really love that rich look that you did on The West Wing. And I said, okay. You know, I can do that again if you want something that has that feel to it. And I said, let's talk about crew. And I said, what about riggers, rigging crew? And they said, oh, we don't have a rigging crew. We never use a rigging crew. And I said, well, then I'm not your guy because that rich look is all about the riggers, you know, You can't walk in and turn the camera on an empty stage like that. You have to, there's multiple days ahead of time of hanging huge lights through the windows and all the things that we do.
And they presume it's a filter afterwards. Digital.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's not a filter. It's not a digital trick. It's just you know, hard work by a lot of people.
And what did they say?
And they said, "Well, okay." And so that was that.
See you later.
And it was fine. Yeah, I went on to do something that was more fun anyway. So it's okay. I mean, I've been lucky with other shows, mostly unheard of, unnotable. But I oftentimes get to do the pilot, and then I try to stick with the series. So the same way that my predecessor on The West Wing did, Tom Del Ruth, you know, he did the pilot and then he stuck it out for many years.
Let's just talk about that, about the many years for a moment, because I'm unhappy with the narrative that exists. That is that when Aaron left The West Wing, things went downhill. There seems to be this, cool people tend to say, yeah, it was good until, you know, Aaron left. Some of my favourite things that happen in The West Wing, the last couple of series, the way that that sort of silvery look of the last series comes about, I love it. It's really first class, and I don't really understand. I feel like there's something perhaps sentimental about people looking back, and they're confusing their relationship with the story, because you as a viewer love those days when it's just the gang together in the White House and all the worlds to play for. And then, of course, things change and you can't sustain that. They have to get reelected, and then there has to be a new incumbent. And I think that they confuse the real world disappointing them with the show being disappointing. You know?
Yeah, I think that's true. Usually, you know, the way that I wind up talking about The West Wing is exactly like this. Somebody makes it all the way through. Some high school friend of mine or whatever will make it all the way through, see my name, and then, you know, ring me up. And I always respond well, because I think it's such a great compliment that when people manage to get all the way through the series.
I just think there's a maturity, and there is more. Aaron's voice is brilliant, but it's very obvious through all the characters in the earlier series. I think in the later series, I really get much more of a sense of individualism with the different characters and the writers. So, well, let's talk about creativity, starting with John Wells. What makes a good boss for you? What is good about John Wells?
There's a meeting before every episode, the director and the producer and the writers, and if I'm lucky, me and script supervisor and the assistant director all sit down and have what's called a tone meeting, where you basically sit there and go, you know, line by line through the script or scene by scene, and you know, discuss what the goal is from every moment. And I've been in, you know, dozens and dozens of tone meetings with a lot of great people, but with John Wells, it's classic. He walks into the room and you go, oh, the smart guy just showed up. And you just kind of know that, you know, he has such an instinct for how to tell a story and how to, you know, keep the thing on the rails while also giving you creative freedom.
And how does that manifest itself?
Well, it would be, you know, you would say in the meeting, the director might say, well, I'm going to approach this scene like this. And John Wells would just say, okay, that's fantastic. Just go for it. Go at it hard. You know? Yeah.
Oh, that's so rare. The number of times that I've heard, you know, the first reaction to an idea is the committee critiquing the idea and pulling it apart so that you create a camel, you know.
It's a little bit like casting, is that, you know, once you cast Martin Sheen, you've kind of done your work. You know, Martin, he's a machine. He does what he's going to do. And it's brilliant. And it's the same with a good director. You don't want to say to, you know, you wouldn't want to say to Martin Sheen, you know, don't put your coat on that funny way.
Exactly.
Because,
yeah,
that's just, you know, it's just who he is.
I want to talk about generations in creativity now. I have this fear that the younger generation, because of demand and supply, are less bold, that the younger guys and girls who break through can be the biggest egomaniacs. And the reason that they break through is because they are insane enough or stubborn enough to go, yeah, you don't tell me what to do, I'm doing it like this. Whereas those guys seem to, you can tell me whether this is the case on the set, but I'm imagining when I used to work with older actors, they had their craft worked out.
It goes both ways. I often make the comparison you just made, but I make it between English actors who have stage experience and Americans who've just done movies or TV. It's that the stage, you know, when you have that stage background, you kind of know, you learn how to prepare in a way that is more, that has more technique to it. So you can, you know where those levers are that you have to pull to get a certain thing to happen in your performance.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I've learned something about life now. You just made me more optimistic. Which is that it's not that I'm noticing the world changing for the worst. It's that actually because I trained in theatre, because my world was theatre, and then I came to the business of entertainment, I was immediately surprised at how few creative people, what I would describe as creative people in the sense of they were doing it for the craft first, rather than people who'd learned the business first.
Actually, I did a day where I worked on Glee for a day a while ago, which was... it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
And I walked in, they have a big theater set that they built. They built a gigantic high school theater. And I walked in and I turned to the lighting guys and I said, hey, I have an idea. Let's try this and this and this and this and this. And they turned to me and looked at me and they all laughed. And I said, what's so funny? And they said, you're the first person who's walked in here who actually knows the name of all those pieces of equipment. And it was all it was a fly system that I grew up using. And, all the same lights that I grew up using.
Parkans.
Yeah, exactly. In their theater incarnation. Although, interestingly, I use a lot of Parkans now.
Do you?
Yeah, even though others... shoe them, or people oftentimes like to do sunlight through a window. You can do it with one giant light, like a 20K. But a lot of times I'll do it with, a dozen Parkans. So it's
why,
I like the being able to make kind of the church window pattern that the multiple sources will make.
I agree. And I know instantly that you did that on the West Wing. I recognize that.
Yeah, in some places I may have done that, but because I was inheriting somebody else's look, a lot of what was done like through the windows in the Oval Office, those are 10Ks. And
I'm wrong. Got a good effect, but not as good as the Parkans.
Yeah, but there are other. The nice thing about that set, that set was so awesome that it was very hard to have a bad shot in there because everything, everywhere you look, there was something amazing to see.
Well, there are a lot of celebrity set tours.
Yes, but my favorite one was Al Gore, who I could just see the hairs on the back of his neck stand up. He was just like, oh, my God. And he sat down at the desk and he was like, wow, fun.
Oh, poor old Al. That's the only time he's got to sit at that desk.
Exactly, yeah. but he was great. And in fact, the Saturday Night Live sketch that he did where he gives his wife a big, long kiss in the Oval Office.
Yeah,
I shot that, which was a lot of fun. Hey. Yeah, I just
awesome.
Yeah,
so they came out Saturday Night Live, came out to LA.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. They're all pals.
Yeah, yeah.
All the producers.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
When have you seen creativity badly managed?
Kind of the saddest thing in TV right now is that there are good shows that don't go beyond one season because they're not making enough money, or they're not doing the ratings numbers, and the networks don't give them time to find an audience. And I've worked on a few shows like that, and it's just sad. You feel like, we're doing something great here, and nothing comes of it.
Yeah, it's
just very frustrating.
There's a series like Mad Men, and you think, how did that ever get past the first series?
And that's one that I feel very personal about, because I grew up in New York, and my father was an advertising executive. So
no way.
So I saw a lot of that firsthand as a kid.
Yeah. Wow, what was that like watching that back? Were you like, oh, the shits? I knew they were doing that.
Yeah. No, not so much. My dad was a real, you know, good scout. No misbehaving. Although he did manage to marry my mother, who was an actress, and you know, so he pulled that off pretty well.
Okay.
So Broadway meets Madison Avenue.
Yeah, but accurate, you think? Pretty good, pretty accurate scene.
Oh yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah. From what I could tell, you know, but it was great to see it because occasionally I got to see it as a kid, but to be able to relive it a little bit through the eyes of Mad Men was really fantastic.
Is there a mistake that business makes more now than before? You're a bit older than me, I think, but is there a common mistake made by business when it applies itself to management?
The most common thing that I'm aware of is, you know, kind of the network notes or studio notes where you get a bunch of, you know, the business people sitting around a table kind of going, oh, what about this? What about that? And, you know, it's very easy to do that. But, you know, if you have a producer with a vision, a writer with a vision, and a director with a vision, probably the best bet is going to be to let them run and don't try to pull on the reins and turn the horses for no good reason. And sometimes, you know, you get a note down from somebody who, you know, doesn't have the, you know, experience or the background or the
context.
Knowledge. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, God, I've seen that so many times. I mean, something that was said, I would constantly say that in the last few years of my radio career with a friend of mine. We were in a double act and we were a bit more creative probably than the norm. And I tried to articulate exactly that kind of if you allow us to do this thing, then it will pay dividend. For example, I would say, and I'd say the name of, you know, a big star. So I'd say, you know, for example, Elvis Duran. And the answer that would come back would be, yeah, but you're not Elvis Duran, you know. There's kind of, which is harsh. It's that kind of, and it would always come back to me going, if I just ignored all of this, I know that we would be more successful, but I'm too nice to ignore it. I'm better getting out.
Yeah.
I can't live like that. I've got to work with a team who are on the same page.
Yeah.
Or it's just, it's too difficult to swim against the tide of that. And it is all well-intentioned people. They're just, you know, I think that there is something that's just very anti-business that is very anti a lot of business that is risk-taking. They see it as a risk to trust somebody with a vision.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, The Simpsons... The Simpsons is the only TV series that had written into its contract that they couldn't get notes from the network. You can't argue with those results. And you think if the network had got involved on series two of The Simpsons, because they went, oh, this is a success. And they said, okay, listen, we can get more viewers if Homer is less offensive, or we can, that's what they do. They go, how do we offend less people to make it middle lane? And then you'd give it, what, two more series, and it would probably be into the ground, I suppose. But I almost imagine that you are still getting to go to work and not necessarily interact with the people who are giving the notes very often.
Yeah, usually not. I mean, they almost never have notes directly for me because they don't really know what I do, which is just fine.
Great.
But a lot of times, you know, when I, you know, impose the question, what does a director of photography do? A lot of times what I think of is that I just do my best to, you know, guard the director's vision and to, you know, enable the director. Like a lot of times, you know, like a friend will call me up and go, I have a script, you know, I want to do a little low budget film, and I'll read the script and I'll go, oh yeah, absolutely. This is awesome. And, you know, I can see this working really well like this. And that because I'm not investing money, I would just be investing my time. It's easy for me to be a cheerleader. And a lot of times, you know, that's the thing that a director or a writer needs is somebody who, you know, stands on the sideline and cheers.
Yeah.
And then you kind of go, okay, all right. Yeah. If he believes it, then I believe it too.
I'm fascinated by the role that you play because the way I would explain it to a child, I suppose, is that when you're having a great day at the beach on holiday, and the sound and the smell and the sun's warming you and the sun's starting to go down and you're there on Hermosa Beach like I was, and I take a photo, the picture looks crap compared to it doesn't match the experience. And then, of course, you go through your filters, finding tricks of photography to get the emotion back to the situation that the lens has taken out.
Yeah, just like an actor brings a whole set of tools with him, I also bring a whole set of tools with me. And so it's funny, I've had this challenge more with documentary directors than with dramatic directors, but I would say, you know, okay, well, what's the feeling here? What are we trying to, what's the message? Tell me what the message is. What are we trying to get across in this scene? And if you can give me a good answer to that, then I can photograph it for you. But if you don't know, like if you can't tell me what you're trying to say, then I can just aim a camera at it. But that's not the same as photographing it. That's not the same as making it a thing.
Do you see the opposite? Do you watch things? I find it very hard to watch anything in a theater and enjoy it.
Yeah, there are times when I do that. But I'm also very aware of how hard it is to make even a bad movie. I've made some bad movies, and you work really, really hard to do it. It's just as hard as making a good one. And so I'm always trying to be a good audience, no matter what I'm watching, just because I understand, you know, how hard it was that, you know, what the people went through. And the other thing is that you don't know whether it's good or bad until you finish it and see how you feel about it. So, you know, you gotta, you know, even when I've been working on things that I didn't, you know, I was like, I don't know about this. You know, all of a sudden you kind of just go, or like one of my favorite examples of this is, I shot David O. Russell's first movie, which is called Spanking the Monkey.
Oh, I've not seen it.
Oh yeah.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. It's something, it's not a good date movie, but it's fun. It's fun to watch. You know, when we were making it, we were like, you know, busy making this serious drama. We thought we're, you know, working really hard to make things seem, you know, really together and really serious. And then we were at Sundance, and in the first, you know, one of the first couple of Sundance screenings, you know, I'm you know, hovering in the back of the audience, watching, and all of a sudden they're laughing all the way through it. I'm like, oh my God, we made a comedy. I didn't even realize it.
That must be so weird. That must be a satisfaction of TV over film, though, like the length of time that it takes to see the result. And if you sit there, I mean, that's a good result, but if you sit there and go, oh, this is shit. I've put so much time into this.
Yeah, that's true. And also, you know, to me, the satisfaction is really the making of, the shooting of it. You know, I enjoy the being on set. And so with movies, you can only, you know, you can do a few movies a year and you spend a lot of time looking for work. And with TV, you know, you can have one negotiation and then that'll be 6 months of work.
Yeah.
And that's pretty good.
Yeah.
The show that I'm doing right now, which is called Murder in the First, which is produced by Stephen Bochco, is also, you know, it's a police procedural, but you know, it's what I grew up watching, and so it's very satisfying to do one. And also, just to sit in the room with Stephen Bochco is pretty cool, because I think a lot of what I know about TV, I learned from watching his work when I was younger.
I need to figure out how we can get Murder in the First over here.
So, I didn't even get a chance to say thank you to Mike on the podcast. I did off air. But the recording, as I mentioned, messed up so much. So don't use FaceTime recorder. That's my advice. Thank you very much to Mike. Things we've learned. Find a team of people. Stick with them. Which probably means I should get Jamie back on this podcast. Next week, Justin Lee Collins talks about his career making high-budget, silly TV shows. Join us for that. That's not next week. It'll be next time I do this, which might be a couple of weeks. So back to...
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The Poxet Pod for now. Thanks for listening.